for mass production. Again, the leader of the Islamic Revolution walked the talk. He took the first vaccine shot of locally produced vaccine, Coviran Barakat, produced by Shafa Pharmaceuticals, under camera in the presence of top health officials. This was enormously significant. The country's top official, in a show of extraordinary faith and trust in his young scientists and their untapped potential, turns up his sleeve, looks straight into the camera, and calls it a source of honor and pride. As one Twitter user wrote, on the face of it, it appeared that the leader was getting the vaccine, but in reality, the vaccine was against the pandemic of despair and self-doubt amongst the people. It restored people's faith in the sanctions-battered healthcare system and the country's young scientists. In his remarks after getting the vaccine shot, the leader said he was not willing to receive a foreign-made vaccine, so he waited for an Iranian-made vaccine. He also lavished praise on those involved in producing the country's first licensed vaccine. Appreciating the efforts of all knowledge-based firms presently involved in the production of vaccines in Iran, the leader said, "It is very important to honor this national achievement in the true sense of the word. Why should we not use it when we have the opportunity to prevent or cure a disease inside the country?" He also urged local vaccine developers to publish documents and other relevant scientific papers relating to the vaccine for the world to benefit from, unlike those billionaires in the West who refuse to share COVID-19 vaccine formulas with developing countries, and those elites who hoarded the surplus vaccines. Looking back at the timeline of the COVID-19 pandemic in Iran, it becomes crystal clear that the leader of the Islamic Revolution was from day one sure about the capabilities of local scientists to produce a vaccine with high efficacy. From May 2020, when he called for the production of a homegrown vaccine, to June of 2021, when he proudly said that the Islamic Republic of Iran was among five or six countries to produce an indigenous vaccine, and that too under cruel economic sanctions. What is important to note here is that the battle isn't only against the pandemic, but also against the hopelessness and despair that it created, especially in places where vaccines haven't reached yet. The leader's words resonate widely and carry a message for all those people across the world fighting the pandemic and all those people fighting those weaponizing the pandemic. We can beat both if leaders lead from the front.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. people's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In different sectors, whenever our nation has worked hard, it has been able to accomplish great feats. This was the case for the revolution too. This was the case in establishing the Islamic Republic. This is what happened in issues related to the imposed war. The last case is related to the coronavirus vaccine. Our youth did not wait for the miserly foreigners to sell us vaccines. You heard the authorities say that they had bought vaccines from this and that global center and had paid for them. But they are not sending us the vaccines. I mean, this is how the world is. Our youth did not wait to witness this. From the very first days, they started working hard. They worked on manufacturing the vaccine in important ways until they made it. Yesterday or 2 days ago, it was announced and they reported to me in writing that they had manufactured the vaccine domestically. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah. We are now among the 5 or 6 countries in the world that are able to produce the COVID-19 vaccine. And we have good infrastructures in this field. They told me that they can manufacture about 50 million or 30 million doses, something like that. I do not remember the exact number. And they said these can be distributed among the people. This is one of the vaccines that has been made, as was announced a few days ago, and this number of vaccines can be manufactured. There are other vaccines being produced in many other centers. They will also become available one by one, God willing. This shows our nation's capability. This is also true in the area of defense equipment. We needed defense equipment, which they would not sell us. I have mentioned this many times. Our own youth started working, and now we have good, better, and more effective equipment in our country than what we wanted to buy from them foreigners. With these capabilities, with these efforts, with these strong foundations, this nation cannot be disheartened. Their efforts are useless. I think those who are making unreasonable analysis of the situation, which leads to disheartening the people, are doing something very wrong. Thank God, this nation has good capabilities. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lisa M. Brusso, author. This article is published under the heading, Olympics, Unanswered Questions About Serious COVID-19 Risks. Stay tuned for more. With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. Yet, the International Olympics Committee, IOC, continues to give at best cavalier attention to the problem of the viral transmission. When the IOC made the decision to postpone the Olympics in March 2020, there were fewer than 350,000 COVID-19 cases in the entire world. Today, more than that number, some 370,000 are infected each day. In March 2020, COVID-19 had killed fewer than 15,000 people. Last week, COVID-19 killed at least 57,000 people, and that was the lowest weekly death toll since November 2020. Efforts to combat the pandemic remain precarious, with COVID-19 cases increasing in much of the world. The IOC has repeatedly invoked the mantra that 80% of those in Olympic Village will be vaccinated. But that will not be true of the many volunteers, workers, and spectators in poorly vaccinated Japan. Nor will it be enough. Moreover, the IOC says nothing about the variability in vaccine effectiveness. Several countries that rely mainly on vaccine have experienced recent surges in infections, probably due to the ability of the highly transmissible Delta variant, which has become dominant in many countries, to evade the vaccine. Separately, a Ugandan athlete and coach tested positive for COVID-19 upon entry into Japan, both fully vaccinated. Although one would think that the IOC would be particularly sensitive to differences among sports, its risk assessments fail to distinguish among competitions. One-on-one competitions involving close conduct and conducted indoors carry a much higher risk than single competitor events. Wrestling is riskier than weightlifting. Boxing is riskier than badminton. Thomas Bach, PhD, IOC president and gold medalist in fencing, should understand that fencers have a much higher risk of spreading COVID-19 than track and field athletes. The risk of transmission increases with the number of potential sources, the quantity and closeness of contacts, and the time spent in a shared space. It also varies by the nature of different sports. At least daily testing of everyone in the medium and high-risk categories could help to decrease the chance of infectious people being present. To make this work, however, the IOC would need to include everyone in these categories, including the officials, workers, and volunteers. Instead, the IOC is doing only daily testing on athletes whom it deems at risk, without explanation of at risk. Daily testing only works if the test is specific and sensitive and if the results are variable quickly. Within a few hours, even with those caveats, testing cannot be relied upon to pick up every possible infected person in a timely manner. What the IOC recommends is based on a now superseded understanding of how COVID spreads, as if it is transmitted only by large droplets that fall to earth quickly rather than small particles that linger and spread in the air. So the IOC recommends face coverings, even though they do not limit emission or inhalation of small infectious particles. Barriers, even though they do not stop the dispersion of small infectious particles, opening a window every 30 minutes, which is hardly sufficient to lower the concentration of infectious particles in dorm or dining rooms. Notably, air conditioning is not ventilation. Making air colder and moving it around the room is not the same as exchanging new air with old. Rather, it simply distributes an increasing particle concentration throughout the space, which could ensure that everyone in that space inhales an infectious dose, as demonstrated early in the pandemic during the now infamous Guangzhou restaurant outbreak. Stadiums control both spectators and athletes by channeling them through small corridors. Tunnels and corridors, including hotel hallways, are risky places of high density but low ventilation. An urgent risk assessment and review of all environments where athletes, support staff, workers, and spectators will congregate is needed to minimize the risk of exposure. To help the IOC with the basic precautionary steps that it seems unable to take on its own, we pose the following questions. What is the response plan if there is an outbreak of COVID-19 during the games? Why isn't daily testing being conducted on everyone with potential for close contacts using PCR-based testing? Will there be genomic testing to better understand who infected whom and to prepare countries as athletes return? What has been done to evaluate the quality of ventilation in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and venues? What has been done to implement air filtration in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and indoor venues in all areas where ventilation is inadequate? Are there enough resources in the Olympic Village to manage a large outbreak? How will a readily available supply of approved masks be obtained and distributed to athletes? Will workers and others required to spend lots of time in close contact with many people be provided with fit-tested respirators to ensure that they are adequately protected from an infectious dose? How is the IOC updating the Olympic Village and venues in light of the new variants, especially the Delta variant? The best case scenario: the Olympics happen safely, a cause for great global celebration. Worst case scenario, Tokyo 2020 becomes a global mega spreader event, setting a world record for pandemic acceleration. What happens in Tokyo won't stay in Tokyo. For better or worse, the Olympics will affect all of us. The IOC needs to get its corporate act together for the sake of the public and global consequences. the Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. Syria says the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has turned from a technical organization into a political tool by the U.S., U.K., and France to exert pressure on Damascus. Addressing an OPCW meeting, Syria's mission to the UN body said the actions of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog contradicts the principles of impartiality, since the United States has the largest chemical arsenal in the world and the munitions pose a grave threat to international peace and security. The U.S., France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. This is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the U.S. and the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, welcome to the program. Please tell us more about these recent comments coming from Damascus.
Yes, actually, the comments were from came out from the head of Syria's mission at the OPCW in a meeting there. Raniel Rifai said that the OPCW has turned from a technical organization into a political tool in the hands of the United States, France, Britain, and other Western countries that have been implementing policies in line with the U.S. ones in order to pressure Syria and falsely accuse it various accusations, such as still having chemical weapons over here. Now, also, Rifai said that Syria fulfilled all of its commitments when it joined the OPCW back in 2013. And, of course, we all remember how the international community acknowledged that Syria destroyed all of its chemical weapons. However, we still continue to hear accusations by the West that Syria still has chemical substances. Now, we also have to point out that head of Syria's mission, Rania Rifai, also criticized those claims by the United States and its allies that claim that Syria has chemical weapons, saying that those are lies and fabrications. Also, a very important point is Syria always argues and asks a question. Whenever those countries accuse Syria, Syria was in a state of advancing. Syria was advancing against terrorists. So there's a question. Why would a country like Syria use chemical weapons when, one, it has no chemical weapons, two, the ordinary weapons were doing the job against the terrorists?
All right, thanks a lot. Mohammed Ali joining us from Damascus. Let's take a look at our guests for tonight's Spotlight. We have veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia, North Africa, Mr. Elijah Magnea, joining us from Brussels. And also expert on West Asian affairs and former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joins us from Manchester. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. Sir, Syria says that the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog is no longer a technical organization but a political tool in the hands of the United States, the UK, and France to exert pressure on Damascus. How do you view these comments?
Yes, sadly, I have to agree 100% with that take on the OPCW. It's a tragedy that this very important international monitoring body should be corrupted in this way by being politicized by Western powers. The OPCW should be playing an impartial role and should be seen to be extremely impartial, but for the last 2 years, in decision after decision, it has shown that it is a puppet of the Western powers. Now, Britain and America in particular are responsible here. They have stuffed this organization with seconded officials from their own administrations who do not respect the impartiality of the OPCW but carry out the wishes of their masters in Washington and London. And this is basically why the OPCW is well on the way to being completely discredited.
Well, the organization's first president, Brazilian diplomat José Bustani, he backed and expressed his grave concerns over the tampering of the 2018 Duma report, fearing that the OPCW have become a tool of the U.S. government. Give us your take on those comments from the former head of the organization. Those are pretty much identical to what Damascus is saying right now.
Well, he's absolutely right, Mr. Bustani, and he's well-placed to know, given his previous position. I'm afraid in the UN system, and I used to work in the UN after I left the British diplomatic service, I'm afraid in today's UN, if you don't follow the US narrative on important issues, you will never get to be Director General of an organization like OPCW. This organization and other agencies of the UN have become highly politicized by the Western powers just in the last 15 years. And he's absolutely correct that the initial report done by the technical inspectors who went to Duma produced a clear conclusion that there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. And this report was, once it got to headquarters in The Hague, was doctored by the Western officials working within the office of the Director General to produce the opposite conclusion. Why? Well, in order to justify the bombing of Syria, which had taken place even without waiting for the investigation by the US, by the OPCW inspectors.
Let's cross over now to Elijah Magnier in Brussels. Mr. Magnier, revelations, they suggest that the OPCW may have intentionally doctored its findings about the alleged gas attacks in Syria. The scandal, as we know, continued to grow throughout 2020 as OPCW experts. They came forward, they gave testimony as to how their findings had been completely manipulated or ignored in order to present a one-sided or quote-unquote incorrect view of events in order to further an agenda. Is that what Damascus meant when it repeatedly urged the chemical weapons watchdog to avoid politicizing Syrian issues?
Indeed. As your guest said, rightly said, the OPCW is politicized. And when Jose Bustani came out with his narrative saying that we are the inspectors of technical and scientists, and according to the scientist opinion, there is no chemical attack on Duma. And the reason why the OPCW is insisting is to justify the US, UK, and France attack on Damascus. And the whole world watched how the OPCW is lacking trust these days, particularly after the Duma attack. And it is obvious that a lot of pressure was put on the organization that needs an honest watchdog and need honest observer and scientists to go on the site and tell us what's happening, but without taking a side and without being doctrinized by the superpower or the US or the UK opinion. Otherwise, there's no need for them to go and inspect on the ground if the decision is made before the attack.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Magnier. Why would the OPCW, even under pressure, suppress information and its findings? Just thinking about the consequences, what would this do to the body's credibility?
The aim was to attack President Assad that was winning a large part of Syria and freeing most of his territory. And when the international community that worked very hard to overthrow President Assad and allow Al-Qaeda and ISIS to gain territory, notwithstanding the huge investment that the Western countries and many Gulf countries, including Turkey, invested in Syria, it was just an excuse to look for, to bomb President Assad, even though everybody knows that at the time of the bombing in 2018, it was too late to change the balance on the ground. So bombing for bombing, it didn't make any sense. And
regardless, the US, UK, and France went ahead and bombed three position, and they told us that they were chemical site. I mean, how can you bomb chemical site and not risk the spread of chemical products and material in the air that can affect everybody, including civilians in Syria? It didn't make absolutely no sense.
Peter Ford, Damascus, along with Russia, have said in the past that chemical attacks had been staged in Syria in order to incriminate Damascus. There are a lot of arguments that Douma was a false flag attack. Who benefits from these actions? The cover-ups, the alleged false flag attacks, who gains from all of this?
The Western powers and the so-called rebels, obviously. The Western powers needed to justify their illegal bombing of Syria. That's why they can never admit that it was carried out on the basis of a falsehood. That's why they must continue to sustain this this lie. But there's another deeper and more topical reason. They have to justify the continuing war on Syria, which mainly takes the form of economic warfare in the shape of sanctions and withholding reconstruction assistance. In order to continue these cruel sanctions, which penalize and punish the ordinary Syrian people, the Western powers have to maintain the narrative that Assad is the president who gasses his people. So this fakery is the cornerstone of the propaganda strategy which underpins the economic warfare on Syria, and that continues, and that's why they continue to hound Syria over this non-issue of chemical weapons.
Elijah Magnier, same question to you. If you recall, Russia recently warned of possible upcoming false flag attacks to maybe justify exerting more pressure on Damascus. Who actually benefits from all of this?
Well, as Peter rightly said, the only beneficial is just to keep sustaining the narrative of what the U.S. is offering us, including the EU, to impose sanctions on Syria. And now the U.S. and the EU don't have any politics or any strategy to carry on in Syria. All their options are bad from their point of view. So what they are doing is to starve the population and thinking that maybe with sanctions they can curb the public opinion and turn it against President Assad, or perhaps they force Assad to come and negotiate with them. And this is not going to happen. People are getting used to very harsh sanctions, and they are suffering. The local currency is devalued. All the goods are extremely unaffordable for everybody in Syria. And what the only benefit is, just because the Americans don't have any clear policy, they don't know what to do, to stay or to leave. So what they do is they maintain the sanctions under very different excuses, including the chemical attack.
Peter Ford, there were a lot of, with the scandal coming out of the Douma attack, there was a lot of calls for reinvestigating the evidence. Instead of reopening the investigation into places like Douma, the OPCW took a step further and suspended Syria's rights at the weapons watchdog, citing a lack of cooperation. The question is, why should Syria cooperate with the OPCW at all?
That's a very good and fair question. The OPCW, since Douma, or the Americans and the British and the French have tried to give new powers and create new investigating committees and groups and sub-bodies over which they themselves will have more control. All in order to keep up the pressure on Syria and, to some extent, Russia, and to keep trying to exploit this issue. But the fact remains that the inspectors have only been able to carry out one proper investigation into an alleged site of an alleged use of chemical weapons, and that was Douma. And in that case, the first group of scientists and technical experts found that there was no evidence of a chemical attack. And this is why the Western powers have to keep trying to create new groups which will be more amenable to manipulation. It's no wonder that Syria simply refuses to have anything to do with them. They're illegal anyway. They've been set up, these new investigative bodies, they've been set up illegally in terms of UN law.
Elijah McNeil, when the OPCW scandals were unfolding, one journalist took to social media writing that this should be a global scandal. Quote, the suppression of evidence from experts from the OPCW in order to push for war in Syria. This cover-up was ignored by mainstream media. Why was it ignored?
Because there is no accountability for whatever superpower and countries like the US, UK, and France are doing in Syria. Their presence is illegal, and the mainstream media is supporting them because they've been bombarded by the necessity to remove President Assad from power. Everybody has adopted this narrative, and the consequences were unimportant. At the end of the day, after 11 years or 10 years of war, the President Assad is still in power and the Syrian government is stable. Now they're not willing to back off and change the narrative. This is why they don't care about scandal. If the OPCW has lost credibility or not, all world leaders have lost credibility in Syria, not only in Syria, even in other parts of the Middle East. Therefore, this is no longer something that we can, those searching for the truth or voicing the truth can do much about it, at the exception of just mentioning it and just saying it. And the other side is just even closing their eyes or keeping pursuing the same narrative.
Peter Ford, one last question for you. Here's a concerning thought. If the likes of the U.S., the U.K., France, etc., they can pressure the OPCW for their own agendas, then they could very well be doing the same with other international bodies too. Give us your final thoughts.
Absolutely. And thankfully, much of the world is waking up to this danger. Interestingly, 29 countries all around the world voted against the April suspension of Syria's voting rights in OPCW. That's 29 countries who are very alive, I'm sure, to the danger that you just mentioned, that this could be just the beginning of how the international system is manipulated against them and not just Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. Elijah McNeil, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
in the limelight.
Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offence. Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek, he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas, a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by two decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, "We Live in a Desert, We Have to Act Like It. Las Vegas Faces Reality of Drought." Stay with us for more of Oliver Millman's article. Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offence. Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek, he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas, a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by two decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. Lake Mead, the vast reservoir that supplies Las Vegas with 90% of its water, has now plummeted to a historic low, meaning Nevada faces the first ever mandatory reduction in its water supply next year. This looming cutback is forcing restrictions upon the city that has somehow managed to thrive as a gaudy oasis in the baking Mojave Desert. The lake isn't getting any fuller at this time, so we need to conserve every single drop of water, said Kay, an energetic former USF Forest serviceman who wears a Vivis vest and brandishes a badge as he does his rounds, searching for violators. He starts his shift at 4 a.m. A lot of people think because we are government workers, we are not out there at that time, but we are out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year, he said. Kay regularly hands out fines. They start at $80 and then double for each further offense, for the sort of rule-breaking he has spotted in Summerlin, a wealthy Las Vegas enclave where landscapers tend manicured grounds in the soaring heat. Water sprayed onto lawns and plants isn't allowed to flow off the property, but that day a damaged sprinkler had caused water to cascade into the gutter, where the precious resource is lost. "Look, we've got a little creek or stream here," said Perry Kay as he used his phone to video the water snaking onto the road. "If everyone did this, quite a bit of water would be wasted. It's so hot in Las Vegas. This July day's temperature will reach 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit, that the errant water will evaporate within 5 minutes. Perry Kay planted a yellow flag next to the leak as a warning to the homeowners, but a few taps on the computer mounted in his car shows this property had a previous warning, so an $80 fine will be on its way. There's a growing realization, however, that such rules, no watering between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m., none at all on Sundays, won't be sufficient, as Nevada is squeezed by a drought that has escalated dangerously in 2021. In June, the state passed a law to rip up non-functional public turf in Las Vegas, such as grass planted beside roads or on roundabouts, over the next 5 years to save around 10% of city water use. That is just wasteful. The only person who walks on that is the person who cuts it, said Kay, jabbing a finger at a nearby grass verge median. Some people just want to recreate home where they grew up with grass. The new law, along with a financial incentive given to homeowners to replace thirsty grass with more hardy desert plants and rocks, is an acknowledgement that climate change won't easily allow the imposition of a verdant green oasis upon a bone-dry desert basin. A city that contains a huge replica of the Eiffel Tower, sprawling golf courses, and a simulacrum of Venetian canals complete with gondolas can never be said to fit in with its surroundings. But Las Vegas, Nevada, called the Meadows in Spanish due to its natural springs that were pumped dry by the 1960s, is at least aware of its setting in a place so arid that only a few small creosote bushes and tumbleweeds can survive here naturally. We live in the desert. We are the driest city in the United States, in the driest state in the United States, said Colby Pellegrino, Deputy Manager of Resources for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. We have to act like it. Colby Pellegrino said the recent escalation of the drought has been very scary for some Las Vegas residents, although she insists the Water Authority has planned for this moment. Lake Mead's level dropped under 1,075 feet in June, barely a third full, triggering what will be the first ever cutbacks under a seven-state agreement on sharing the water from the Colorado River, which is harnessed by the Hoover Dam to create the reservoir. Different states get different water allocations, and Nevada is a victim of its depopulated history, getting just 300,000 acre-feet of water a year. By comparison, California gets 4.4 million acre-feet of water under an agreement struck before the Hoover Dam was completed in the 1930s. The joke is that Nevada's representative was drunk, said Pellegrino, who was born in 1983, when the state's population was barely 900,000. It's now more than 3 million and receives tens of millions of tourists a year. The small water allocation will shrink by 21,000 acre-feet with the new cuts, although Nevada has made impressive strides in keeping below its low cap, slashing its water use despite the population nearly doubling since the early 2000s. Colby Pellegrino is confident that further savings can be made, and scrutiny is being placed upon the water used in Las Vegas's casinos' ubiquitous cooling systems. But global heating impact upon the West's snowpack and rivers is unrelenting, and the city's water savings will only go so far. Las Vegas only has a supporting role in its own fate. Three-quarters of allocated Colorado River water is used to irrigate thirsty agriculture, and the overall water supply is more dependent upon the amount of snow melting hundreds of miles away in the Rocky Mountains and some extra marginal savings made in the suburbs. Las Vegas has done great things, such as ripping out the grass but we've lost 20% of the flow of the Colorado River since 2000, and another 10% loss by 2050 is completely possible, said Brad Udall, a water and climate scientist at Colorado State University, whose research has focused on the stresses facing the Colorado River. I worry it could be even more than that, and that should frighten everyone. Back in Summerlin, Perry Kay is also relentless. A house opposite the first offender has broken sprinklers splurging water into the puddles on the grass and road. Perry Kay bangs on the ornate door to inform the homeowner, but no one is in. These sprinklers haven't popped up properly. They're just oozing everywhere, muttered Perry Kay. He has been policing water waste for the past 16 years, issuing countless fines in that time. I had hoped I would have worked myself out of a job by now, but it looks like I will retire first.